All this year, we've looked back at the events of 1968 in a series called How We Got Here. In today's finale, it's the musical soundtrack of 68.
You say you want a revolution. Well,
you better think about what you're trying to do to me.
In a white room with black curtains,
could you find me?
Yes, we probably left out some of your favorites. That's because 1968 stands out as one of the greatest years in the history of pop music. We asked NPR's Joel Rose to find out why.
It's not just baby boomers who are infatuated with the music of their youth. Even people born decades later hear something happening in 1968.
I think everybody's always trying to go back there, to be honest.
Meg Baird is a singer, songwriter, and musician who lives in San Francisco, the same city that nurtured its own sound half a century ago in a flowering of psychedelic bands, including Jefferson Airplane.
You get these crystalline, crazy guitars. You get Grace Slick just singing almost like through her third eye, you know, through the room.
They cannot tolerate our minds. In loyalty to our kind, we cannot tolerate their obstruction.
There's this kind of blossoming in what was possible.
Why do you think that was possible?
I really don't know what was the magic formula. People were so, you know, their minds were just open for it.
Maybe part of the fascination is hearing musicians trying to break free from the industry's formulas.
There was a cookie-cutter aspect to the most pop music at the time. People wanted to make hits.
John Simon was part of that machine as a staff producer at Columbia Records in the 1960s. But by 1968, the world outside of the recording studio was in upheaval, and musicians wanted to capture the spirit of what was going on.
They really realized that I was part of the rebellion and not part of the establishment. Part of being the rebellion is you could rebel musically in the studio.
John Simon worked on some of the most acclaimed albums of 1968, from Simon and Garfunkel's Bookends to Cheap Thrills by Big Brother and the Holding Company, the record that introduced Janis Joplin to a wide audience. And Simon produced the first record by a group of musicians who were best known for backing up Bob Dylan. He remembers the first time he heard the demos that became Music from Big Pink by the band.
What I heard was just great. It was just so different. The forms were different, the instrumentation was different, the attitudes. And so I said, yeah, count me in.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said.
The band recorded live in the middle of the studio and knocked out almost half of the album in a day. Other bands spent hours obsessing over a single track. But no one pushed the recording studio or the electric guitar further than Jimi Hendrix.
Have you ever been? Have you ever been to Electric Ladyland?
Nobody had recorded guitar sounds like that. No one had made sounds like that in the studio.
Vernon Reid is the founder and guitarist of the band Living Color. When Hendrix started out, Reed says, he was a sideman who was supposed to play second fiddle to others.
We played in rock and roll and R&B bands where the lead singer was the king, and he got fired all the time.
But Hendrix's very first album of his own was a top 10 hit. So in 1968, he was free to pursue the sounds in his head on a groundbreaking double album called Electric Ladyland.
Took this notion of freedom seriously. He was one of the great musical liberators.
Well, it's too bad that our friends can't be with us today. Well, it's too bad. The machine that we built
that's what they say.
Sometimes the musical rebellion of 1968 was sonic abstraction, and sometimes it was more direct. James Brown recorded his anthem to black empowerment in Los Angeles in August of 1968. Saxophone player and bandleader Pee Wee Ellis co-wrote the song. He says it was Brown's idea to bring in a bunch of neighborhood kids to sing the chorus.
That part was very simple. All they had to say was, I'm black and I'm proud. And done it in one take.
Pee-wee Ellis says audiences across the country learned their part quickly, too.
We recorded that song in Southern California, and by the time we got to New York, a couple weeks later, we were playing the Apollo Theater. James Brown came on stage and said, say it loud. And the whole entire audience said, I'm black and I'm proud. Gave me goosebumps.
So why does the music of 1968 still give audiences goosebumps half a century later?
If you are trying to think about 1968, hearing those audiences in those rooms is a pretty cool way to at least get a peek.
Thank you very much.
Singer and musician Meg Baird says one of her favorite records of 1968 is not on many top 10 lists from that year. It's a double album, half live, half studio, by the British folk jazz band Pentangle, called Sweet Child.
You can feel how fun it must have been to be in that band. They're so good, and the way that they're playing together, it gets shared with the listener and the audience. Making the music they wanted to make. This is music that was meant to be heard in a hall. It's not meant to be in a rock club or a folk club. It was allowed to be art, you know?
To suggest that popular music could be art, that might have been the most rebellious move of all. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.